Like, I gotta be honest with you, that's it's a good idea.
Hey, Sebastian, first of all, thanks for jumping on to record with me. Today, we're going to be talking about user-generated gaming. And I know you think that that's a future. The future is user-generated gaming, and you think that's the sort of frontier. So we can talk about that. But before we jump into that, can you talk just, really briefly about who you are? And I was just talking to you briefly before we started recording about seeing you on a number of podcasts and things like that. And maybe you can also talk about your rationale for being a bit more visible or, coming onto different podcasts.
My name is Sebastian, Seb Park on Twitter. I have been in gaming and esports the last 10 years. I was fortunate enough to start off in esports, was the VP of esports for the Houston Rockets, creating a couple teams, including Clutch Gaming and League of Legends, that we sold to the fine folks over at Harrah's Blitzer and the 76ers and became Dignitas. In 2020, became a venture partner at BitCraft, focused on user-generated gaming, esports, and Web3. And then in 2021, a year later, created and co-founded Infinite Canvas, which is a user-generated gaming, user-owned publisher of sorts.
Okay, so it makes sense why you think user-generated gaming is a future. You're doing what you believe.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like a large rationale behind pushing forward was in part because we just didn't see the type of company I wanted to invest in. I was like, hey, I'm an operator first. Let's get back into this. And so that's a lot of fun. To your second question about why, being more public and talking more through ideas, there's like two parts of it. One is that insofar as we're in a bear market, I think actually ideas get lost in the signal noise, in that people, when it's a bull market, like to talk about things, like to be futuristic and optimistic. It's harder to be optimistic in a bear market just because the entire world is telling you you're wrong. I think optimism is just incredibly important. And so the first main reason is like, hey, I actually think that irrespective of what's happening in the markets, this ecosystem is great. There's a lot of value here and the people should be more involved in it. But second, and I think this is also really important, is I found that the best way to iterate on my ideas and beliefs is to get feedback. And it's really easy, especially during the pandemic and then subsequently in the last few months, to be insular, right? Just to have your ideas, talk to people who agree with you and keep that loop going. It's much harder to have your ideas tested by like the court of public fires, right? And so part of the user-generated bit is honestly for my own benefit, which is, hey, I want to spread this idea. I want people to tell me I'm wrong, tell me what's wrong with my ideation, so that I can then update it and make sure that both our philosophical opinions, but also our like operational direction is correct. And it's always nice to hear from really intelligent people that way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, especially that you make regarding feedback. And certainly I think that during a bull market, even with investors, you could kind of sense that even investors are probably a little bit more reluctant to give harsh or negative feedback just because, they want to do a deal and they don't want to be too negative. But I think it is an important function, whether it's coming from potential investors or other folks in the industry and things like that. So I think that's great. So maybe we could actually dive in and talk about, when I spoke to you initially, we talked about a number of different topics, all to me really interesting. But for you, I wanted to kind of understand why you think the next frontier is user-generated gaming and what you mean by that. So maybe you could kind of characterize your thesis in terms of your view on UGC.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think the first thing to talk about is what I call the creator-to-consumer ratio. And I think we've talked about this before, which is in any given ecosystem, like throughout the history of the world, there is a number of consumers and there's always fewer creators than there are consumers. The ratio, as far as I can tell, just in the research I've been looking at, was that the ratio used to be 100,000 to 1. In for the last 20 years or so since the internet, before that, it was 10 million to 1, right? Like it was like really hard to be a creator in the, pre-printing press era. It was really hard to be a creator pre-internet. But once the internet came about, especially in video, we started seeing 100,000 to 1. For every 100,000 people consuming the content, there was someone making content. What's been really awesome, and I think this shows up not only well, especially in Gen Z, but not only there, but also just generally as part of the macro trends of content creation in video, writing, gaming, etc., is that that ratio is decreasing, right? It's like going from 100,000 to 1, and especially with the democratization of tools and ease of access, it's coming down to like 10,000 to 1. One of my favorite stories I tell people is that my younger brother is a cinematographer. So, you know, he like has a degree in that. He's been a practicing cinematographer about a decade now as well. He, you know, before in a different era, that's how you did it. It's like you had to get a degree. You have to go like intern for someone. You had to be a production assistant. Nowadays, we have YouTube. We have these democratized tools that people are learning from YouTube to make content on YouTube. What's been really cool about gaming, and this is sort of the evolution what we see, and by we, I mean my co-founder, and myself, is that what we saw in video was that once the tooling was there, people started making things. And that became part of the cultural zeitgeist of that generation, where people were going to make video. It made sense to be not only a consumer, but also a creator. We're seeing that, and we're starting to see the beginnings of that in gaming as well. We've known that with these tools, especially with like Warcraft 3 Map Editor, and more recently in platforms like Roblox, Fortnite Creative, and Web3 as well, that people are now making things in mass because it's just easier to make it. And I think that's been really cool to watch. And that's really the underpinnings of what I think about user-generated gaming is the democratization of tools, allowing people to create more games. The favorite anecdote with Joe, I know you remember deeply, is it was really hard to make games like 15 years ago. Right? I remember starting off at the beginning of the mobile gaming boom, right? So we were just going from Facebook over to mobile, and you need to know, you know, basically linear algebra for a lot of the physics engine stuff. You need to understand not only Objective-C, but also the interplay of graphics engines and everything coming together. And if you built for Android, there was no way it was going to work on iOS and vice versa, right? Everything was boxed in itself. And since then, we've even seen it at the high level with Unity and Unreal being far more accessible to people who don't necessarily have a PhD in like that type of computational math, right? And so we're starting to see that even get easier and easier. And that's where we're seeing the explosion of creativity on the user-generated side.
Yeah, I think that the analogy that you're drawing between social networking, which is, you know, is essentially... To your point, really help enable like that ratio between creators and consumers to be much lower, right? Like on Facebook, everybody is a creator to some degree. And we see that happening with like Twitter and other platforms where people now, it's so much easier for someone with a voice or something interesting to say to be discovered. And similarly to the point you're making in terms of game development, like there's a number of folks, whether you're using blueprints in Unreal or you're using or you're developing Lua for on Roblox, where that sort of development vector between idea to product, right, to publishing, has just gotten dramatically smaller. So I think that that's you know, I would agree with you in terms of the thesis, in terms of democratization and the ability for more people to become creators.
Yeah.
But having said, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, my favorite story, by the way, of this is not only just the tooling, but also the cultural zeitgeist, as I think it's really important to mention, right? Which is, It used to be that the most sought after job in America, like 30 years ago, was like astronaut or some type of pre-professional pathway, right? And today it's more creator. It's YouTube. Like kids are like, oh, I want to be a YouTuber. I want to be a maker of things. That jump is, I think, really cool because it's also demonstrative of what you're starting to see inside of, you know, the top universities in the United States, where people who are graduating from Stanford aren't saying, I'm going to go work at Goldman Sachs or Google. They're often saying, hey, I want to take my shot on creating something, building a company, doing something interesting.
Right. And I think the other thing that has been interesting is with platforms like Twitch and YouTube, the ability for the economics to make sense for just like some random person to just quickly and cheaply make videos and then have economics flow back to them in a way that can sustain their work. But maybe the other thing I could ask you then is if you were to, for our audience, if you were to think about how you think about on a high level, the different ways in which UGC manifests in games, right? So we see platforms like Roblox. Mm-hmm. We see the ability to create custom mods or maps, you know, in various games, and also the ability to potentially create cosmetics and sell that, you know, in a marketplace in the game. But are those the three primary ways that you're seeing UGC content manifest in games, or what are the other, how else would you think about it from a high level?
Yeah, I mean, so the answer is yes, right? Those are their main ways. People are making games themselves. They're making modifications of existing games, and they're also creating in-game items or in-game game modes for them, right? And so you're able to play a different take on the existing IP. There's an interesting book, just as an aside, by this gentleman named Derek Thompson, who wrote a book called Hitmakers, where he talks specifically, like, the entire thesis boils down to people don't like things that are like super different. They like things that are like 1 degree off. And that's really a lot of this creation. And it's just, as you take the degree per the existing idea and push it out, it starts to look more and more unique over time. But that's really the thrust of the type of user-generated content. It's like cosmetics, it's items, it's game modes, game loops, games themselves, new approaches to existing IP, new IP from existing IP as a derivation thereof. What's interesting, and I think this is part of the deeper question that people are going to ask, is that actually changes the dynamics of games, which I think is a really fun idea to explore. If you think about what and one of the things that we do at BitCraft, for example, is we think a lot about what does it mean, what's like the pain point of an industry? Like, what is a thing that's missing? For 30 years or so, and like, let's going back to even the 60s, the hardest part was hardware, right? Like, it was like, hey, how do we make these processors small enough such they can fit in this giant box so that people play arcade games? Then for a couple decades, it was distributions. Like, hey, how do we get on the shelves of Toys R Us, the shelves of Best Buy, the shelves of these stores, and get that 4-foot to 5-foot area for people to see it? And, you know, in the 2010s, it was a lot about taking that digitally. So you have your Steam, you have your apps or your Play Store. You have the ability to see and find games that way. And distribution was really important insofar as user generated is concerned, and people are making these cosmetics and items and games and modes. It switches from being a distribution issue, because distribution is built into these platforms. It becomes a discovery issue, which is actually, I think, one of the more cool things about this forum, which is there are going to be more games now. And there already are more games, by the way, but there are more games you can possibly ever play. And thus, it's now crested over into the world of like books and music, for example, where it's like, hey, the limiting factor is an ability to like find engineers and game developers and designers. The limiting factor is to be discovered, even if you're good. And then you have like this really interesting tournament model of employment type of thesis applied to game making, which wasn't the case for a number of years.
Right. And so, Seb, one question I have for you that though is like, when we think about just coming back to like this framework in terms of platform like Roblox, mm-hmm. mods like, you know, Warcraft 3, and the ability to build in-game items that you sell or resell, what are you seeing in terms of like the biggest opportunity against those three models? And then maybe you could also tell us what you're doing with Infinite Canvas, and does it fit into one of those three categories cleanly, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, so I think depending on where you're approaching the problem from, there are going to be different parts of the value chain that make sense. As a game developer, and I'm going to just use esports as a quick example, because I think esports is an emergent behavior that's very similar to user generated. In that esports, a lot of people thought was a user acquisition funnel, right? They're like, hey, we're going to create an esport, professional video game, to drive more people to our games. And over time, people have come to the conclusion, or people are coming to the conclusion, that's more of a retentive tool that's actually super useful for League of Legends to have an esports department, because it keeps people to continue to play, which is awesome. Similarly, on the UGC side, I like to think of it, does it help your monetization? Does it help your user acquisition? Does it help your retention? UGC, depending on which part of the platform you are and where in the game cycle is, can help all three, but only if you target it specifically. So, for example, user-generated cosmetics will help monetization far more than it helps retention. User-generated game modes, like the actual modifications, is really helpful for retention of the players, but probably less so for monetization for most people. And then user-generated from the perspective of creating content and creating new games, is your game becomes a user acquisition funnel for another game, which I think is really cool. our belief at Infinite Campus is that we focus mostly on the user-generated games themselves, looking for differentiated game loops and new things out in the market.
Okay. Is there any more information you can... Are you still kind of like in stealth mode, or is there more details you can provide about Infinite Canvas? Like
I mean, so we're not in stealth at all. We started on Roblox. Our approach was basically, let's be completely agnostic to the game modes. We're not the target audience. The target audience is between 13 and 24. Nobody on our team, except maybe one person, is under the age of 24, right? Like, I think most of us have like 10, 20 years of experience at this point. And it's really hard, I think, and this is like one of the hardest parts of being a creator or a developer, right?
Yeah.
You get enough experience that you think you have intuition and taste, and then you realize you're no longer a target demo, right? Like that you were the target demo when you started out in the industry, and you no longer are. And so our approach was, hey, there are a lot of game modes and games that are being overlooked because they feel too simplistic, or they look bad, or they look different than what we would expect to be fun. Our data model finds those games. We reached out to those games initially. Like, our initial reach out funnel was we would just DM people on Twitter, be like, hey, we think your game is really awesome. We think we can help. Let's run in and run it back. Nowadays, it's actually the other way around, where we get a lot more inbound. But, you know, we work with like, you know, 2 to 3 dozen games at this point, and we improve their loops and help them bring their game from a game that, you know, may monetize poorly but have great eyeballs, or vice versa, and then get them to the point where they make more money and are on more platforms and are doing more interesting things, mostly in search of a differentiated super hit or a home run.
Okay, so would you characterize yourself as more of like a UGC content publisher, and Roblox is one of your distribution channels, as well as, you know, potentially other platforms and games? Or
I think that's fair. I think the way we talk about ourselves is far more like we are what Activision would have looked like in 2022 if they had started this year, as opposed to, you know, 30 years ago. It's far more we're agnostic to Roblox or Fortnite Creative or, you know, Manticore or Rec Room or Web3. It's just wherever the users are. And we believe that the best games that were created the last 10, 20 years were all modifications and slight derivations of existing IP. And that these platforms are going to demonstrably show new game loops that are going to be ton of fun, and that no designer that we know in our circle of people we know would have made in a vacuum. And that's really what the search and goal is.
Right. And not to like focus too much on those three categories, but if I were to think about your business and the potential economics against, let's say, you know, mods versus creating a game on a platform, mm-hmm, versus like creating items for a marketplace within a game, would you say that as a, you know, call it UGC publisher, that I would say most of your opportunity currently would just be in terms of like, you know, helping independent developers or studios build for platforms like Roblox? And because I think when you look at some of the other categories, like building mods, like some of the greatest games in the world, like, you know, Warcraft 3's, you know, Defense of the Ancients became League of Legends, yep, and, you know, H1Z1 King of the Kill became, right, you know, basically Battle Royale.
Dota, like, Auto Chess became Auto Battlers, which is also fun, right?
That part doesn't seem to be, the economics there doesn't seem to have a publishable opportunity. Or do you think, like, so I guess my question is, in terms of those three categories, is it all about games on platform, or do you see new opportunities opening up elsewhere?
Yeah, so it's mostly the latter, actually. It's mostly we're looking for, at the end of the day, what we're looking for is your next Dota or next Auto Chess or next H1Z1. And we think that here is a world where people are making thousands of games a day, effectively. We can work with these games. We can, you know, acquire the games. We can publish the games. We can do different types of rev shares with these games. And as we improve the loop, we're working with game types and game loops that we've never seen before in terms of, hey, like, why would this make sense? Like, and I think that's been really cool. And so that's actually, I think, a large part of the economic upside of the business is, hey, how do you find a differentiated game loop ahead of time? Well, you have to be in the weeds of where those game loops are being developed.
Interesting. So if I understand that, just so have this correct, if you see like a game mode or mod, like let's say you stumbled across King of the Kill, then you would have reached out to Brendan Green and said, hey, let's turn this into a game. You basically would have done the Krafton model.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think that's actually a pretty interesting approach, and it's certainly what we do often. It's like we find, so a good example of this is our data model saw a dunking loop game on Roblox, where it's really a simplistic game loop. You run around dunking a basketball. We thought it was a ton of fun. We talked to the creator. We're like, hey, we love to develop your game and make it into a, instead of a single shot game where you dunk over people, let's create different worlds, let's create different levels, let's turn it into a live ops experience and give people and reasons to keep coming back and, you know, monetize better, really show what the game's potential is. We did like a deal with Beats by Dre to implement the Beats by Dre headset that you can like get by dunking in the game, etc. And it really worked out for us, right? Like the game ended up massively outperforming any metric that we thought it could have performed prior to working on it. And now we have that dunking game, you know, in perpetuity in terms of not only on this platform, but also looking at, hey, does it work on Fortnite? How does that loop change on Fortnite? How does that loop change in Web3, for example? And more importantly, how does it continue to grow in Roblox? And I think that's very much in line with what we've done historically and what we tend to focus on, as opposed to necessarily working with indie game developers in the vacuum. Part of this is development cycles. These people who are making user-generated games on platforms like this have development cycles in the order of magnitude of like days and weeks, as opposed to months and years. And so it's very interesting to see people take an iterative shot on goal and then call it a day.
Yeah. And maybe two follow-up questions with respect to what you guys are trying to do. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that a couple of things would be important for you to be successful. The first has to do with discovery, right? So a lot of times some of these mods are very underground.
Yep.
Where, you know, whether it's, you know, you were around to know about Defense of the Ancients during, you know, the Warcraft 3 modding days or things like that. How are you doing discovery? Are you guys sitting in Reddit forums? Is there a data-driven way of trying to find some of these like potential mods or games or experiences that can be turned into something bigger? What does your discovery look like?
Yeah. So I think discovery is an interesting two-sided coin in that I'll talk about how we find these games and then we'll also talk about how we then take these games to the masses. On the finding thing, there are two main mechanisms. So the first one is our data model, right? We do a lot of fun data work. The first version of it was just looking at user velocity and acceleration. How many users are coming in? How much are we doing it? How fast are they growing or how slow they're growing? And we would just reach out to them and talk to them and be like, hey, you've crested above our bright line of interest. We haven't even looked at the core loop of the game yet because we don't want to bias ourselves from like what a good game and bad game is. And then we start working with them. And that I think was the initial loop. We've been fortunate that, you know, Tal and I care a lot about long tail reputation. Like, I think that's like an incredibly important part of not only being a publisher, but being a creator or an entrepreneur in general, is that you can't treat people poorly. And you have to treat them well. And if you do so, there are actually long tail upsides for that. We've been getting a lot more inbound the last 6 months. In the last 6 months, especially this year, it's been very much pockets of creators who we've worked with before or have helped out in some capacity coming to us and being like, hey, have you looked at this game? Have you seen this? Have you heard of this? Have you? Here's the game that I just made. And that's been really cool from a discovery side. But at the end of the day, you know, we have a data science team. So it's very much constantly trying to find the next game that's doing interesting and being completely blind to what the game is. I think that's so incredibly important. One of my favorite things from the time in basketball was just if you get over-indexed on what someone looks like, you're going to miss like, you know, hidden gems. And for us, it's very much we trust our data and we make sure we trust our data in order to avoid having that problem. The second part, which is the same issue that we have finding games, we understand that users and players will also have problems finding these games. For that side, we lean heavily into discovery as our big moat. A lot of it involves working with creators, content creators, like video, like YouTube and Twitch creators, TikTok creators, to be like, hey, play our games, check out these games, let your audience know if you like it or dislike it. And if so, they'll at least give it a try. And if it's retentive and fun, they'll keep playing. If it's not, we'll find out very quickly. And two, communities. Less so Reddit, more so I would say guild.gg, guild.gg, Discords, your actual person-by-person communities, as opposed necessarily Reddit communities.
Okay, cool. And like the second aspect of your business, if I'm understanding correctly, would just be your value proposition to different creators, right? Like how do you convince them to work with you? I can imagine one thing, like one thing that I've heard from some Roblox creators is that once they like come up with a new game, then all of their time gets sucked into the game and, you know, kind of like the 0 to 1 versus 1 to N mm-hmm. emphasis in terms of how they spend their time. And they want to just do more 0 to 1, especially when, you know, a lot of the tools are there to create new games. But so I can see one value proposition from that side. But how do you speak to some of these guys in terms of convincing them to work with you?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was hard. Like it was truly hard at first. I think people fail to understand, and I certainly fail to understand half the time just how annoying it is being a founder at times. Where, you know, I think the first few months it was very much the data model would spit out Twitter handles, and then we would just DM people being like, "Hey, we think your game is awesome. Here are ways we think we can help improve your game." And we did about like 100 of these a week for like 10 weeks, where we're like just finding games we thought were interesting, reaching out to them, letting them know our backgrounds and working with them. Nowadays, we have like a nice like library of games you can point to, be like, "Hey, here's how we've helped other people. Here are the exact ways we've improved your user acquisition, retention, monetization." That's been a lot of fun. I want to drill in onto the 0-1 to 1-N part, which is I've traditionally found that there are innovators and then there are operators, especially in gaming. And a lot of people we work with, especially on the creator side, are innovators. They're trying to innovate, push the edge. But they don't have necessarily the desire or patience to do live ops. You and I know that a lot of the monetization of games, especially in free-to-play nowadays, is long-tail live ops, like sunsetting or not, games over multiple years and cohorts. That is a painful and often boring process for a lot of creators.
Yeah, and it's a different skill set.
And so a lot of what we offer is that skill set. It's like, hey, we're, you know, if you work with us, it's not necessarily that you're going to, the game is not going to just change dramatically on you. We're going to stick to your vision. We almost never do deals where we take 100% over. We always want to make sure that they are part of the overall vision community. And let's update this while it frees you up to go work on the next game, the next game, the next game, which I think is a decent way to do it. And then we focus more on the tooling necessary to operate multiple games at scale.
And maybe to give the audience a better concept of kind of like the universe of things that you look at, when you think about good examples of UGC creators out there, are there any specific names that come to mind that you think that people should check out in terms of interesting innovations or games that you think are good examples of the kind of opportunity that you're looking for?
Yeah. I mean, I would say there are a couple that just jump straight up to mind. One is not even a game. I recommend checking out this young woman named Anna LaRue. She is a user-generated clothing creator for Roblox. And she's lovely. She's brilliant. And her mental model on how you make clothing is so differentiated because she didn't have your traditional fashion background. Like she was just, you know, a teenager making clothing. And it's grown to this really interesting thing that's completely different. The other cohort I'd look at, honestly, is I would look deeply at some of the hit games on platforms like Roblox and on Fortnite. The Roblox one I point out to is there was a game called Piggy that was really popular a year ago, which was really a murder mystery run from someone type game, but had like 17 chapters of a really esoteric story, like no story that any proper like classically trained writer would write, but was created by this creator called Minitoon. He's like a brilliant young man at this point, and it was just to his own zeitgeist. It was to his creative group. The third category I actually would say, honestly, is I'd even reference back into video. I check out Snapchat and TikTok in particular and look at the creators there and sort of the meta that's evolved. And I think that's some of the coolest things that we're seeing on platform and that we have to be really aware of. And it's why we're interested in Roblox, but also Snap Games and Snap Lenses and everything else is these metas evolve where people become used to a specific format of video or a specific format of game. And then you see like 1,000 variations of it. And it's really fun to see. On TikTok, there's the dancing thing, obviously. But recently, there's been an explosion of deep explanations pared down to 60 seconds. And there's just like an entire TikTok microcosm of that. And I think that's very similar on platform and gaming. For example, last year there was a big explosion in Roblox of tycoon style games where you're, you know, collecting a bit of money and building a roller coaster, just like Roller Coaster Tycoon, but different types of things, a mall, a carnival, etc. That I think is an interesting way to see the ebbs and flows as a platform changes and the zeitgeist differentiates. On mobile right now, I think Ice Cream Maker is the meme of the day. Whatever Voodoo is working on usually is like a pretty good approximation, whatever the free-to-play zeitgeist is at that moment.
Got it. Okay, yeah, and maybe something else you could probably look at is popular ad creatives, right? That might be another way of trying to check.
100%. And I think especially after the changes, you know, we have SK Ad Network 4.0 coming out in a bit, and obviously the Apple changes are, you know, demonstrably affecting the entire ecosystem. We're starting to see some really interesting ad creative on that side as well, because it's just less hyper-targeted. And so because it's less hyper-targeted, you have to rely on more zeitgeist-based things. And I think that's been really cool to watch.
Yeah, and I think in terms of ad creatives, a couple of trends that I thought were interesting from a couple of years ago and last year were just like the, you know, there was like this huge wave of mob type of behavior, like swarms of zombies and things like that. And then somebody in trouble, right? Like somebody's in trouble, you got to save that person. And we saw in games like Royal Match from Dream Games that actually got incorporated, that kind of a theme got incorporated into their game. Okay, well, in terms of like some of the existing game studios, if you have an existing game that doesn't have UGC elements to it, would you give any advice in terms of how existing game studios can think about, well, I have an existing game, it's doing pretty well, but maybe I could try and apply UGC to the game in some way. What kind of recommendation would you make for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question is understanding how many users you have. Let's assume a bullish world where the ratio is 10,000 to 1. Well, if it's 10,000 to 1 and you only have 9,000 users, it doesn't matter if they're the most, like if they're the richest 9,000 users in the world and you're making millions of dollars, you're just probably not going to see a creator in that ecosystem that's going to make something interesting. Like that's like a priori constraint where you have to have enough users in order to drive that creation. The second bit is honestly, I would personally start with just asking like what people would want to make and then checking YouTube. Oftentimes, one of the cooler things is that people create modifications. A common one on Roblox is people create mods to like click really quickly because there's a lot of clicking games like Cookie Clicker. So you have an auto clicker. Like see what people are making and then effectively open up a small sandbox area of your world for people to do just that. I think that's a really good place to start. The biggest thing that we talked about at the top was just that N plus one idea where it's small deviations or derivations that really make a larger pie. It's the exact same approach for user generated. I think too many people, typically games nowadays, go for broke and they think this is going to be like a 12-year process of creating this editor. And it's just not the case. Like for the most part, you open up one bit at a time, see the traction, you open up another bit at a time, and then grows from there. GTA Online is a great example of something that's more emergent behavior and exactly what we are. But all of these things have one thing in common, which is you need to have a ton of users interested in either your IP or your game itself in order to seed this community. And just doesn't follow the same type of metric tracking that we would see necessarily in general free-to-play.
Got it. And maybe the last question I can ask you, Seb, is that when we think about some of the user-generated content or gaming platforms out there like Roblox or Manticore or platforms like that, it does seem like, at least from a demographic perspective, it seems like Roblox is pretty much wrapped up like the kids market. Mm-hmm. But do you think in the future, is it a winner-take-all market, or do you see additional platforms coming in? Do you see additional UGC platforms for older demographic that you know comes to the market later as well? Or how are you viewing UGC from a kind of market share perspective?
Yeah, so this might be a hot take. I'm not convinced that you can acquire users over the age of 30, period. And part of this is because I think people just lock into what their desires are. And then they lock into their taste. There's a lot of research. It's not particularly well researched. It's like an unresearched part of the world. But that people like lock into what they like in their 20s and 30s. And it basically sustains them for the rest of their life. One of the questions I always had in the esports world was, people would always ask, how do you acquire 35-year-olds. And my response for a number of years was, you wait 10 years for the 25-year-olds to become 35. And by the way, for what it's worth, if you look at the trend lines of esports, that's happening, where the average age of esports fans is increasing, in part because there are new generations of people who, you know, followed Brood War in 99 and now are, like, you know, in their mid to late 30s, maybe 40s now. And those are the fans who are still fans of esports. They just gotten older. Like, it's not that there was some 39-year-old who hadn't heard of gaming before who suddenly became a League of Legends fan. It's that it was the gamers from that generation getting older. One of the cool things I've seen on the creator side is that this next generation, Gen Z, which I would characterize as, like, you know, anyone like 24 or below at this point, or 27 or below, is used to creation as being part of their day-to-day life. If you think about how old they are relative to how young our ecosystem is, most of them don't remember a time pre-YouTube, right? Like, that's like they're used to the idea of things being made. And so when I look at platforms like Roblox that have a grip on that, like, age demo, that's, I think, more of a function of it being around for that age demo. There are going to be other platforms that target different age demos, but they will grow with the group of people they've captured. Same thing for Snapchat. Snapchat, actually, I think, is a ripe user-generated ecosystem for when they launch, in part because they really have captured anyone from the age of, I think, around 21, 22 to 29. Like, that's like a pretty core, or 27 maybe, a pretty core Snapchat demo that's really powerful. Roblox is really doing well between, I think, like 14 to 17, 18. And that's going to scale up because every year the 17-year-olds are going to turn 18, right? And the 18-year-olds are going to turn 19, and the 14-year-olds are going to turn 15. I think that leaves a lot of opportunity. My best example, and the why you should believe this, honestly, is if you look at Dota as an ecosystem and you look at the age curve of Dota, it's consistently gone up. It's unclear if they're acquiring new users, right? It's unclear that anyone wakes up in the morning and becomes a Dota player inherently, unless they had an older brother or an older sibling or an environment that exposed them to the game and they went from there. And as that age demo goes up, the modding community of that game changes as well. Teamfight Tactics and Dota Auto Chess and Underlords emerge from a user-generated environment filled with Dota players, which I think is a really interesting cohort versus other types of games. Fortnite, I think, is a super interesting cohort. Minecraft is another interesting cohort. At least for the time being, it doesn't look like it's going centralized as strongly as your YouTubes and Twitches have. And it's going to coalesce around cohorts of gamers, regionality, and age brackets as people just continue to play the games and are used to things that they're used to.
Awesome. All right, Seb. Well, thanks so much for speaking about your company and your view on user-generated content and your thesis in terms of the future. For folks that are interested, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can just find me on Twitter. It's Seb Park, S-E-B-P-A-R-K. And I'm fairly active on there, and I respond to pretty much every DM eventually.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, that's it, everybody. And we'll catch you next time.